I've been criticized for trying to make that trade, but I have no apologies. There wouldn't be a new convention center in New York City today if it hadn't been for the Trumps. More important, the city would have saved a fortune by letting me build the center, which I very much wanted to do. Instead, Ed Koch decided, by some logic I could never understand, that because I'd helped arrange the sale of the property, it was a conflict for me to be the builder as well. Eventually, I offered the city a deal that, frankly, was ridiculous for me. I said I would bring the entire job in for less than $200 million, and that if there were any overruns, I'd pay for them myself. You won't find many builders willing to put themselves on the line that way. Instead, the city and state decided to oversee the job, and the result was perhaps the most horrendous construction delays and cost overruns in the history of the building business. A man named Richard Cahan was put in charge of the Urban Development Corporation, and ultimately, it was his job to oversee the convention center project. Richard Cahan is a nice man, but he had visions of being the next Robert Moses. It wasn't clear that he had the experience or the talent. One of the first things Cahan did was to hire I.M. Pei as his architect. I.M. Pei is a man with a terrific reputation, but in my view, he often chooses the most expensive solution to a problem, and is virtually uncontrollable. Immediately, Pei decided to design a space frame for the center, a structural system that any professional builder will tell you is one of the most difficult to build and is especially vulnerable to cost overruns. This is particularly true when you're dealing with the sort of huge space frame they needed for a convention center. From the very start, I told Cahan and his people that it was critical to build a parking garage simultaneously. How can you have a convention center without parking? They told me that a garage would hold up the city's environmental impact approval. Look, I said to them, those approvals are only going to be tougher to get later. And at the very least, you should begin a separate filing for the garage now, so you can at least start the process. They ignored me. And now they have no parking, and no prospect of building any in the near future. The choice of where to put the entrance was equally ill-considered. If you put the entrance at the west, the whole center faces the Hudson River, which is a beautiful view. Instead, they built the entrance on the eastern side of the building, facing the traffic on 11th Avenue. As I watched all these mistakes being made, I became very angry and frustrated. In 1983, when it was clear the construction of the convention center was already a disaster of delays and overruns, I wrote a letter to William Stern, who by then had replaced Richard Cahan as president of the Urban Development Corporation. For a second time, I offered, this time for no fee at all, to oversee the project and to assure that it would get completed quickly and without further cost overruns. My offer was refused, and a disaster eventually turned into a catastrophe. By the time the convention center was finally finished last year, it was 4 years behind schedule, and at least $250 million over budget. When you add interest, the carrying costs for all those years of construction, the total cost was probably $1 billion, or $700 million over budget. The construction was a terrible disgrace, and all the worse because no one raised a fuss about it. When I was invited to attend opening day ceremonies in 1986, I refused. What happened at the convention center is that the city and state took a great piece of property and a great project and ruined it through terrible planning and ridiculous cost overruns. Even if the convention center is ultimately a success, it can never earn back all the money that was unnecessarily squandered to build it. The funny thing about devoting so much time and energy to the 34th Street site is that I never considered it anything to compare with the 60th Street yards. The problem was that developing 60th Street proved even more difficult than promoting 34th Street. The community opposition was stronger, the zoning was more complicated, and the banks were highly reluctant to finance a huge residential housing project in a city still teetering on the verge of bankruptcy. In 1979, I reluctantly let my option on the 60th Street Yards expire so that I could concentrate on other deals that seemed more immediately promising. The first one, fittingly, was with Palmieri and the Penn Central for the purchase of the Commodore Hotel. Chapter 6. Grand Hotel. Reviving 42nd Street. During the period when I was trying to make something happen with the two West Side Yards, I got more and more friendly with Victor Palmieri and his people. One day, late in 1974, I was in Victor's office, and I said to him, half-jokingly, "Listen, now that I've got the options on the two yards, what other properties does the Penn Central own that I can buy for nothing?" "As a matter of fact," said Victor, "we have some hotels you might be interested in." It so happened that the Penn Central owned several old hotels within a few blocks of each other in Midtown. The Biltmore, the Barclay, the Roosevelt, and the Commodore. The first three were at least moderately successful, which meant buying them was likely to cost more money than I wanted to spend. The only one in real trouble was the Commodore, which had been losing money and defaulting on its property taxes for years. As it turned out, that was the best news Victor could have given me. I decided very quickly that the Commodore, in the heart of New York at 42nd Street and Park Avenue, next to Grand Central Station, had potentially the best location of any of the four hotels. I still remember walking over to look at the Commodore the day Victor first mentioned it to me. The hotel and the surrounding neighborhood were unbelievably run down. Half the buildings were already in foreclosure. The brick facade of the Commodore was absolutely filthy. And the lobby was so dingy it looked like a welfare hotel. There was one of those sleazy flea markets operating on the ground floor with a bunch of boarded-up storefronts on either side, and derelicts lying in the doorways. To most people, it would have been a very depressing scene. But as I approached the hotel, something completely different caught my eye. It was about 9 in the morning, and there were thousands of well-dressed Connecticut and Westchester commuters flooding onto the streets from Grand Central Terminal and the subway stations below. The city was on the verge of bankruptcy, but what I saw was a superb location. Unless the city literally died, millions of affluent people were going to keep passing by this location every day. The problem was the hotel, not the neighborhood. If I could transform the Commodore, I was sure it could be a hit. Convenience alone would assure that. I went back and told Victor I was interested in making a deal for the Commodore. He was pleased, because everyone else considered it a loser. I also went to my father and told him I had a chance to make a deal for this huge Midtown hotel. At first, he refused to believe I was serious. Later, he told a reporter that his initial reaction to my idea was that buying the Commodore at a time when even the Chrysler Building is in receivership is like fighting for a seat on the Titanic. I wasn't naive. I saw potential, but I also recognized the downside. I could envision a huge home run, but I also knew that failing could bury me. From the very first day I went to work on the deal, I tried to keep my risk to an absolute minimum, and financially, I succeeded. But as the months went by, the deal became more and more complicated and difficult. I kept investing more time and more energy, and the stakes rose for reasons unrelated to money. I could talk big for only so long. Eventually, I had to prove to the real estate community, to the press, to my father, that I could deliver the goods. The Commodore deal was basically a juggling act, but a much trickier one than I originally imagined. First, I had to keep Palmieri's people believing I was their best bet to buy the hotel, while trying to avoid, for as long as I could, putting down any cash. At the same time, I had to convince an experienced hotel operator to come in with me before I actually had a deal, knowing that such a partner would give me more credibility with the banks when I went to seek financing. And even a great partner wasn't enough. I also had to try to persuade city officials that it was in their interest to give me a totally unprecedented tax break. That savings, I knew, would make it far easier to prove to the banks that the numbers for my hotel made sense, at a time when they were loath to lend money even for projects in good neighborhoods. The funny thing is that the city's desperate circumstances became my biggest weapon. With Palmieri, I could argue that I was the only developer around who would even consider buying a loser hotel in a decaying neighborhood in a dying city. With the banks, I could point to their moral obligation to finance new developments as a way to help get the city back on its feet. And with city officials, I could legitimately argue that in return for a huge tax abatement, I'd be able to create thousands of new construction and service jobs, help save a neighborhood, and ultimately share with the city any profits the hotel earned. In the late fall of 1974, I began talking seriously with Palmieri about a deal. 8 or 9 months before, the Penn Central had invested $2 million on a renovation of the Commodore. That was the equivalent of applying a coat of wax to a car that's just been in a major accident. Even after the renovation, the Penn Central was projecting a huge loss for 1974, and that didn't even include the $6 million that the hotel already owed in back taxes. The Commodore was a terrible cash drain on a bankrupt company. In a short time, we came up with a basic structure for a deal. In simple terms, I would take an option to purchase the hotel at a price of $10 million, subject to my being able to get tax abatement, financing, and a hotel company partner. Subject, in other words, to my putting the entire deal together before I made the purchase. In the meantime, I would put down a non-refundable $250,000 for an exclusive option. There was just one problem. I wasn't too eager to fork over even $250,000 on a deal that was still very much a long shot. In 1974, $250,000 was a huge sum of money for me. So I stalled. Contracts were drawn up, but I had my lawyers find plenty of little legal points to argue back and forth over. In the meantime, I went to work to try to put the rest of the deal together. What I needed first, I decided, was a really fantastic design, one that would get people excited. I set up a meeting with a young, talented architect named Der Scott. We met at Maxwell's Plum on a Friday night, and right away I liked Der's enthusiasm. When I told him what I had in mind, he immediately started making sketches on one of the menus. The key thing, I told Der, was to create something that looked absolutely brand new. I was convinced that half the reason the Commodore was dying was because it looked so gloomy and dark and dingy. My idea from the beginning was to build a new skin directly over the brick, bronze, if it could be done economically, or glass. I wanted a sleek, contemporary look, something with sparkle and excitement that would make people stop and take notice. And it was obvious to me that Der understood what I had in mind. After we ate, I took Der and another friend back to my apartment, the tiny studio I was living in on 3rd Avenue, and I asked him what he thought about my furniture. Some people would just have said, "Fantastic, great." But Der didn't do that. "There's too much of it," he said. And he started moving furniture around, and even pushed several pieces out into the hallway. When he finished, he managed to make the apartment look much bigger, which I liked. I hired Der and paid him to come up with sketches that we could use in our presentations to the city and to banks. I also told him to make it appear that we'd spent a huge sum on the drawings. A good-looking presentation goes a long way. By the spring of 1975, we were pretty far along on our design. Then one evening in the middle of April, Der called to tell me that he'd been fired from the architectural firm he worked for, Kahn and Jacobs Helmuth, Obata and Kassebaum. I knew he hadn't been getting along with his bosses. At the same time, I didn't want to hold up the project. I needed the resources and the prestige of a big firm to do a job this size, and I figured it was going to be a while before Der made a new association. But he formed an association very quickly with a firm named Grusen and Partners, and I was able to use the situation to my advantage. The Obata group desperately wanted to keep the job, and so, of course, did Der. The competition gave me an opportunity to negotiate a lower architectural fee, which I did. In the end, I went with Durr and paid him a very modest fee. I also told him that doing this job would pay off big in the end. "This is going to be a monumental project," I said. "It's going to make you into a star." Durr wasn't thrilled about his fee, but later he admitted that I'd been right about the impact that doing the Hyatt, and subsequently Trump Tower, had on his career. During this same period, early 1975, I began to look for an operator for the hotel. The truth was that I knew nothing about the hotel business. I've learned a lot since then, and today I operate my own hotels. But at the time, I was only 27 years old, and I'd hardly even slept in a hotel. Nonetheless, I was trying to buy this monster building, 1,500,000 square feet, and proposing to create a 1,400-room hotel, the largest since the construction of the New York Hilton 25 years earlier. It seemed clear that I needed an experienced operator. I also figured it probably had to be one of the large chains, and I wasn't totally wrong. The chains may not be very exciting, but they do give you access to a national reservation system, good referral business, and basic management expertise. From the start, Hyatt was at the top of my list. Hilton seemed a little backward and old. Sheraton didn't excite me for much the same reasons. And Holiday Inns and Ramada Inn didn't have enough class. I liked the Hyatt image. Their hotels had a modern look, light and clean, and a little glossy. And that was what I had in mind architecturally for the Commodore. In addition, Hyatt was very strong on conventions, which I thought could be a big business for a hotel in the Grand Central area. I also liked Hyatt because I thought I might have more leverage with them in making a deal. Chains like Hilton and Sheraton already had hotels in New York City, and they weren't necessarily hungry to build new ones, particularly with the city in the dumps. Hyatt, on the other hand, was very successful in other cities, but still had no flagship presence in New York City, and I'd heard they wanted one very badly. In late 1974, I called up the president of Hyatt, a guy named Hugo M. Friend, Jr., and we arranged to meet. I wasn't terribly impressed with Skip Friend, but it turned out that I was right about Hyatt's desire for a New York flagship, and we began to discuss a partnership on the Commodore. Fairly rapidly, I made a tentative deal with him, full of contingencies. I was very happy and very proud of myself. Then 2 days later, I got a call, and Skip said, "Nope, I'm sorry, we can't do the deal that way." This became a pattern. We'd negotiate new terms, shake hands, a few days would go by, and the deal would suddenly be off again. Finally, a guy I'd become friendly with at Hyatt, a high-level executive, called. "I'd like to make a suggestion," he said. "I think you should call Jay Pritzker and deal with him directly." I'd barely heard of Pritzker, which tells you something about how young I was at the time. I knew vaguely that the Pritzker family owned a controlling interest in Hyatt, but that was about all. My Hyatt friend explained that Pritzker was the guy who really ran the company. Suddenly it dawned on me why my deals kept coming apart. If you're going to make a deal of any significance, you have to go to the top. It comes down to the fact that everyone underneath the top guy in a company is just an employee. An employee isn't going to fight for your deal. He's fighting for his salary increase or his Christmas bonus, and the last thing he wants to do is upset his boss. So he'll present your case with no real opinion. To you, he might be very enthusiastic, but to his boss he'll say, "Listen, a guy named Trump from New York wants to make such and such a deal, and here are the pros and cons, and what do you want to do?" If it turns out his boss likes the idea, he'll keep supporting you. But if the boss doesn't like it, the employee will say, "Yes, I agree, but I wanted to present it to you." By now, it was the early spring of 1975, and I called Jay Pritzker, and he seemed happy to hear from me. Hyatt was based in Chicago, but Pritzker told me he was coming to New York the next week, and we should meet. Could I pick him up at the airport? I didn't go around in limousines at the time, so I picked him up in my own car. Unfortunately, it was a very hot day, and it was extremely uncomfortable in the car. If it bothered Jay, though, he didn't show it. I realized right then that Jay is very focused when it comes to business. He can be fun-loving when he's relaxed, but mostly he's tough and sharp, and he plays very close to the vest. Fortunately, I had no problem with that, so we got along pretty well. The other thing about Jay is that he doesn't much trust people in business, which is the way I tend to be. We were wary of each other, but I think there was also mutual respect from the start. We managed to make a deal in a short time. We agreed to be equal partners. I'd build the hotel and Hyatt would manage it once it was built. More important than coming to a tentative agreement was the fact that from then on, I was able to deal directly with Jay when difficulties arose. To this day, though we've had our disagreements, the partnership is strong because Jay and I can talk straight to one another. On May 4, 1975, we called a joint press conference and announced that we'd agreed, as partners, to purchase, gut, and fully renovate the Commodore, assuming we could get financing and tax abatement. The announcement of the partnership with Hyatt, coupled with Durr's preliminary drawings and rough construction cost estimates, finally gave me some ammunition to bring to the banks. By then, I had hired Henry Pierce, a real estate broker with a special expertise in financing. Together, we went calling. Henry Pierce was the head of a firm called Pierce, Mayer, and Greer, and he was a fantastic guy. He was in his late 60s, but he had more energy than most 20-year-olds, and he was unrelenting in his quest for financing for this job. His persistence helped, and so did his age. We'd go in together to see these very conservative bankers, most of whom had never heard of Donald Trump. In many ways, I was much more conservative than Henry, but it reassured these bankers to see me alongside this white-haired guy with whom they'd been dealing forever. Our pitch was very much the one I made when I first met Victor Palmieri. I would talk about the great Trump organization and all we had done. I would push very hard the fact that we built on time and on budget, because I knew that the banks were scared to death of cost overruns, which can kill even a good loan. We would show these bankers drawings and scale models of this huge, gleaming new hotel I planned to build. We would talk about how the job was going to turn the neighborhood around, how it would create thousands of jobs. We would go on and on about the fantastic, incomparable Hyatt Company, and we'd even mention the great tax abatement we hoped to get from the city. This last point would usually stir some interest, but unfortunately, we were in something of a catch-22. Until we had our financing in place, the city wasn't interested in seriously discussing tax abatement. And without tax abatement, the banks weren't very interested in talking about financing. Eventually, we decided to take a new tack. Realizing that the positive approach wasn't working, we tried to play to their guilt and their fear and their sense of moral obligation. "Forget us," we'd say. "You owe it to New York. The city is in trouble, but it's still a great city, and it's our city. And if you don't believe in it, if you won't invest in it, how can you expect it to turn around? If you lend millions of dollars to third world countries and suburban shopping mall magnates, don't you also owe some obligation to your own city?" Nothing seemed to work. On one occasion, we found a bank that seemed ready to say yes. Then at the last moment, the guy in charge raised some trivial technical issue that just killed the whole deal. This guy was what I call an institutional man, the type who has virtually no emotion. To him, it's purely a job, and all he wants to do is go home at 5 and forget about it. You're better off dealing with a total killer with real passion. When he says no, sometimes you can talk him out of it. You rant and you rave, and he rants and raves back, and you end up making a deal. But when a machine says no, it's very tough. We gave this guy every argument in the world, and after listening, he didn't flinch and he didn't move. He just said very slowly and steadfastly, "The answer is no, Donald. No, no, no." After that experience, I remember saying to Henry, "Let's just take this deal and shove it." But Henry refused to give up. He and Jerry Schrager, my lawyer, kept me going, and we continued to push. It was increasingly clear that the only way I was going to get financing was if the city gave me tax abatement. My hope rested in a program called the Business Investment Incentive Policy, which the city adopted in early 1975. It was designed, in a bad market, to encourage commercial development by providing tax abatements to developers. In the middle of 1975, I decided to approach the city, even though I hadn't found financing. To most people, that would have been ridiculous. I took it one step further. I went in and asked for the world, for an unprecedented tax abatement, on the assumption that even if I got cut back, the break might still be sufficient. In a funny way, it was like a high-stakes poker game in which neither side has very strong cards, so both are forced to bluff. By this point, I almost couldn't afford to walk away from the deal if I wanted to maintain any credibility. The city, meanwhile, was more desperate than ever to encourage development. I first made my case to the city in October 1975, and it was direct. The Commodore was losing money and deteriorating fast. The Grand Central neighborhood was turning into a slum. The Hyatt Hotel chain was ready to come to New York. But there was no way we could afford to put up millions to build a new hotel unless the city gave me some relief on property taxes. The city's economic development people agreed to structure a program in which we'd effectively be partners. The city would give me a total abatement of property taxes for 40 years. In return, I would pay the city a yearly fee and a share of any profits the hotel made. The mechanism was fairly complicated. First, I would buy the Commodore from the Penn Central for $10 million, $6 million of which would immediately go to the city to pay off the back taxes. Then I would sell the hotel to the city for $1, and they would lease it back to me for 99 years. My rent, paid in lieu of all property taxes, would begin at $250,000 a year and rise by the 40th year to $2.7 million. Also, I would pay the city a percentage of the profits. At the end, I'd be paying the equivalent of full property taxes based on the hotel's assessed value as of the time we were making our deal. The whole arrangement was subject to approval by the city's Board of Estimate, which met to consider it for the first time in late December 1975. A week before the meeting, I went to Victor Palmieri and explained that if he wanted the city to take our abatement seriously, we had better make it clear that the Commodore was in deep trouble and that it might not survive much longer. He agreed with me. On December 12th, Palmieri announced that the Penn Central had lost another $1.2 million on the Commodore during 1975, was anticipating worse losses for 1976, and as a result, intended to close the hotel permanently no later than June 30th, 1976. 2 days later, there was another significant announcement, which I hadn't anticipated. Portman Associates, a company that had spent the past 2 years trying to get financing for a huge new hotel across town in Times Square, revealed that it was scrapping the project because it had been unable to get bank support. In a way, that was bad for me, because I needed all the evidence I could get that investing in New York made sense. On the other hand, in dealing with the city, I could point to the Portman fiasco as clear proof that the only chance I had to get financing was if they gave me my tax abatement. Early in 1976, the Board of Estimate decided to switch the structure of the tax abatement program. Instead of my selling the hotel to the city and then leasing it back, I would do the whole deal through the state's Urban Development Corporation. The reasons were technical, but actually the change was advantageous to me. Unlike the city, the UDC has the power of condemnation, meaning the statutory right to evict quickly and efficiently, something that a private developer can spend months or even years trying to do. By April, however, the Board of Estimates still hadn't considered my tax abatement, and opposition to it had begun to intensify. The loudest chorus came from other hotel owners. Albert Formicola, head of the city's Hotel Association, argued that the tax abatement would give me an unfair advantage competing against the other hotel owners in the city who paid full property taxes. The head of the Hilton, Alphonse Salamone, said he could understand a 10-year tax abatement, but that everyone ought to compete as equals after that. Even Harry Helmsley, who was more successful and less envious than most of my competitors, said he thought the deal was a little excessive. Just before the Board of Estimate vote, three city councilmen held a news conference in front of the Commodore to denounce the deal. I didn't take it personally. They were politicians. They sensed an issue that might play with the voters and the press, so they jumped on the bandwagon. I worried about the growing opposition, but publicly my posture was to take the offensive and concede nothing to my critics. When a reporter later asked me why I got a 40-year tax abatement, I answered, "Because I didn't ask for 50." The basic case against us was that the city was giving me too rich a deal. The length of the tax abatement was only part of it. In addition, critics said, there shouldn't be a cap on the profits I shared with the city. Also, if my maximum rent was going to be equivalent to the full property tax assessment as of 1974, then that number should at least be adjustable so that it could take into account the possibility that real estate values and assessments might rise over the years. If I'd been the city official in charge of negotiating with me, I might have made those same arguments. But while other hotel owners were great at carping, not one of them made an alternative offer for the Commodore. Admittedly, most everyone assumed I had an exclusive option on the property, and it helped that the city didn't dispute that. Several months earlier, a city official had requested that I send along a copy of my option agreement with the Penn Central. I did, but it was signed only by me, and not the railroad, because I had yet to put down my $250,000. No one even noticed that until almost 2 years later, when a reporter doing a story on the deal called the city and asked to see the original agreement. 2 weeks before the Board of Estimate was scheduled for the third time to vote on my plan, an alternative offer finally was made for the Commodore. It came from a company that owned a bunch of low-rent hotels in bad neighborhoods. If the city could get title to the Commodore, these people said, they'd be willing to buy it, put up a couple of $1 million toward a renovation, share all profits with the city, and forego a cap. Because it was a half-baked offer from a questionable group, I think it actually helped my case. The last thing the Commodore needed was a second-rate renovation by a third-rate hotel operator. The clincher, I'm convinced, came from Palmieri and Penn Central. The one thing that nobody wanted was to see the Commodore shut down and boarded up. On May 12th, Palmieri announced that the Penn Central was going to close the Commodore permanently in 6 days, exactly 1 day before the Board of Estimate had scheduled, for the fourth time, a vote on my tax abatement. Immediately, the critics called the announcement a pressure tactic. I can't say I was unhappy about the timing, but the fact was that the Penn Central had revealed 6 months earlier its plans to close the hotel by summer. In the meantime, occupancy had dropped from 46% the previous year to 33%. Moreover, losses for the full year of operation in 1976 were projected at $4.6 million. On May 19th, all the local papers carried front-page stories about the last tenants moving out of the Commodore, the hundreds of employees who were now looking for work, and the dread that local shop owners were feeling in anticipation of a boarded-up hotel. The story certainly didn't hurt me. On May 20th, the Board of Estimate voted unanimously, 8-0, to give me the full tax abatement program I'd sought. Over the course of the 40 years, that abatement will save me tens of millions of dollars. The battle was more than worth it. Whatever my critics may have felt, a New York Times editorial 10 days later made my case better than I could have. "The alternative," said the editorial, "is the Commodore boarded up and in tax arrears. Beyond the tax loss, this would be a visual wound and a serious depressant for one of the city's prime areas." But incredibly, getting the tax abatement still didn't convince the banks we had a viable enterprise. When you look back, it seems almost hard to believe that the banks could doubt our numbers. What it shows you is how bad things were. In 1974, the Commodore was charging an average of $20.80 a night for a room. And as long as occupancy remained above 40%, the hotel nearly broke even. In our entirely new hotel, we projected charging an average of $48 a night for our rooms, with an average occupancy rate of 60%. Those were hardly great numbers, but the banks insisted we were being too optimistic. As it turned out, by the time we opened our doors in September 1980, the city had turned around, and we were able to charge $115 for a single room, with an average occupancy of more than 80%. By July 1987, we'd raised the room rate to $175, and now we average almost 90% occupancy. In the end, we got our financing from two institutions. The first was Equitable Life Assurance Society, which, in addition to its other businesses, owns a lot of real estate. George Peacock, the head of Equitable Real Estate, agreed to put up $35 million for the Grand Hyatt, primarily because he and his people thought it would be good for the city. The other institution was the Bowery Savings Bank, which happened to have its headquarters right across the street from the Commodore, and agreed to lend $45 million. Their motivation was practical. They didn't want to see their own neighborhood go to hell. I could have saved millions and millions of dollars just by refurbishing the old Commodore, rather than creating a brand new building. Indeed, almost everyone fought against my spending the extra money on a major renovation. From the day we went public with our plans to cover the Commodore's brick facade with an entirely new curtain wall of highly reflective glass, critics and preservationists were furious. They were outraged that I wasn't making some attempt to fit in with the architecture in the rest of the neighborhood. The classical look of Grand Central Station and the ornamented limestone and brick office buildings up and down the block. In my view, staying with that look would have been suicide. I said to these critics, "Hey, fellas, do me a favor and don't tell me about these great monuments, because the Chrysler Building is in foreclosure. The neighborhood is a disaster, and it's obvious something's not working. If you think I'm going to leave the facade of the old Commodore the way it is, you're crazy. There's no way." It's strange how things can turn around. Many of the same critics and preservationists who hated the original concept of my building now love it. What they discovered is that by choosing this highly reflective glass, I've created four walls of mirrors. Now when you go across 42nd Street, or go over the Park Avenue ramp and look up at the Grand Hyatt, you see the reflection of Grand Central Terminal, the Chrysler Building, and all the other landmarks, which otherwise you might not have noticed at all. The other new element that had a dramatic effect was the lobby. Most hotel lobbies in New York are dull and unexciting. I was determined to make ours an event, a place people wanted to visit. We chose a luxurious brown Paradiso marble for the floors. We used beautiful brass for the railing and columns. We built a 170-foot glass-enclosed restaurant pitched out over 42nd Street, which no one had ever done before. I'm convinced that if I'd left the Commodore the way it was, old and dull and nondescript, it would have had absolutely no impact, and it wouldn't be doing the business it is doing today. The Grand Hyatt opened in September 1980, and it was a hit from the first day. Gross operating profits now exceed $30 million a year. Hyatt's job was to manage the hotel, so my role was essentially over. But the fact is, I still had a 50% interest, and I'm not exactly the hands-off type. That caused some problems at the start. I would send over one of my executives, or more often, my wife, just to see how things were going, and Hyatt wasn't happy about that. One day I got a call from the head of all the Hyatt hotels, Patrick Foley, and he said, "Donald, we have a problem. The manager of the hotel is going nuts because your wife comes by, and she'll see dust in the corner of the lobby and call over a porter to clean it up, or she'll see a doorman in a uniform that's not pressed, and she'll tell him to get it cleaned. Unfortunately, my manager happens to be a guy who has a problem with women to start off with. But in his defense, he's running a hotel with 1,500 employees, and there's got to be a chain of command, or else a business like this just doesn't work. So I said to Pat, I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you that it's a real problem. But as long as I own 50% of the building, I'm not going to walk in and make believe everything's fine if it isn't. Pat suggested we meet the following week. I wanted to work this out because I like Pat, and I respect him, and I think he is an extraordinary executive. Pat has one of those great Irish personalities. He'll walk through the Hyatt Regency in Washington, D.C., or West Palm Beach, Florida, and he'll know everyone's name. He'll remember their families. He'll kiss the chef, tell the porter he's doing a great job, say hello to the lifeguard and the maids. By the time he leaves an hour later, everyone feels uplifted, like they're 10 feet tall. So I met with Pat, and he said, I've decided what to do. I'm going to change managers. I'm going to put in one of my best guys. He's Eastern European, like your wife. He's also very flexible, and they'll get along great. That way she can come in and talk to anyone she wants, and everyone will be happy. Sure enough, Pat made the switch. And then his new manager did something brilliant. He began to bombard us with trivia. He'd call up several times a week, and he'd say, Donald, we want your approval to change the wallpaper on the 14th floor. Or, we want to introduce a new menu in one of the restaurants. Or, we are thinking of switching to a new laundry service. They'd also invite us to all of their management meetings. The guy went so far out of his way to solicit our opinions and involve us in the hotel that I finally said, leave me alone. Do whatever you want. Just don't bother me. What he did was the perfect ploy because he got what he wanted not by fighting, but by being positive and friendly and solicitous. As successful as our partnership has turned out to be, there was one small clause in the deal that I think may be even more valuable than my half-ownership of the Grand Hyatt. It's something called an exclusive covenant, and its effect is to permanently prohibit Hyatt from building competing hotels in the 5 boroughs of New York without my permission. I first tried to get the covenant from Jay Pritzker at the time we made our deal, but he refused. Jay is a smart guy, and he wasn't about to foreclose the future expansion of his hotel chain in one of the biggest cities in the world. We finally got to the closing, and just before we all sat down, I was alone with an executive from the bank. I pointed out that this was a rather big and risky investment the bank was making, and that one way to further protect the loan might be to insist on a restrictive covenant, so that Hyatt couldn't throw up a second hotel 2 years later, right down the street. The banker saw the implications immediately. He stormed into the room where the Hyatt people were sitting, and he said, Hey, fellas, we're putting up tens of millions of dollars, which is a lot of money, and we're not going to make this loan unless we get a covenant from Hyatt saying you won't open up any other hotels in New York. I was taking a chance, because right then and there the whole financing could have fallen through. But what I had going for me was that Jay Pritzker wasn't at the closing. The executive representing Hyatt tried to reach Jay, but it turned out he was off in Nepal, mountain climbing, and he couldn't be reached. Meanwhile, the bank gave Hyatt 1 hour to make a decision, or that was the end of the financing. While we were waiting, I wrote up a covenant myself. In effect, it said that Hyatt can't open any competing hotels in the New York area, including the 2 airports. The only exception is the right to build 1 small luxury hotel, which I don't believe would be economically feasible anyway. And before the hour was up, they agreed to sign the document I'd written. I now have in my will a clause describing the importance of that restrictive covenant, just on the chance that one of my heirs happens not to be that sharp. What I don't want, after I'm gone, is for some nice, smooth person from Hyatt to come to one of my heirs and say, Listen, you wouldn't mind if we threw up a little non-competitive hotel at Kennedy Airport, would you? The simple fact is that Hyatt would love to build more hotels. By retaining the right to say yes or no, I own something very valuable. I've already seen the proof. A.N. Pritzker, a wonderful man who was the patriarch of his family and who died recently, used to call me frequently when he came to New York. A.N. and his son Jay were very different men. What they had in common was brilliance. But where Jay keeps very much to himself, A.N. was extremely effusive and outgoing, almost a teddy bear. They were a perfect combination. A.N. built the foundation of the company from nothing, and he got the banks to back him not because he had great assets, but because they loved him. Now the company has a huge base, and Jay, who is a much cooler personality, doesn't need the banks to love him. He can be very tough, and they still want to do business with him. Anyway, A.N. would come to New York, and he'd call and he'd say, "Hiya, Don, I'm here visiting, and I'd love to stop over and just say hello to you for a couple of seconds." And I'd say, "A.N., I know what you're doing. You want to build a hotel someplace in New York, don't you?" And he'd say, "I'd love you to let us do that, Don, because it's not going to hurt you, and it's good for us, and it's good for everyone." And when A.N. would do that, I'd find some way of changing the subject, because I liked him so much that I never had the heart to say no to him directly. There are very few people I feel that way about. A.N. died in 1986, and I happened to have an extremely important business meeting in my office on the day of his funeral in Chicago. It was a deal I very much wanted to make, and I'd been planning it for months, and people were flying in from all over to be there. But I canceled the meeting in order to go to Chicago, and as it turned out, I was never able to make that particular deal. I have no regrets. There are some people in your life you just want to pay your respects to, no matter what it involves. And in the end, I think one reason my partnership with Hyatt has remained so strong, beside the fact that the hotel has been so successful, is that I always felt such affection for A.N. Pritzker. Chapter 7. Trump Tower. The Tiffany Location. It was not an auspicious start, my meeting with Franklin Jarman. From the time I took an apartment in Manhattan in 1971 and began walking the streets, the sight that excited me the most was the 11-story building at 57th Street and 5th Avenue that housed Bonwit Teller. The main attraction was location, but in addition, it was on an unusually large piece of property. In my mind, that combination made it perhaps the greatest single piece of real estate in New York City. There was the potential to build a great building in a prime location. Bonwit was owned by Genesco, a company founded in the late 1950s by a gentleman named W. Maxey Jarman, who built it into a real high-flying conglomerate. Maxey started off with a shoe company, and then he began buying other shoe companies. And eventually, he moved into retail stores, purchasing Tiffany and Henri Bendel and Bonwit Teller. But then, in the mid-1970s, a tremendous battle began to take shape between Maxey and his son, Franklin. They were both strong guys with their own ideas, and they both wanted control. It became so bitter that they finally came to blows at a stockholder meeting. Since I am so close to my father, I found the whole thing hard to believe. But the bottom line was that Franklin finally managed to push his father out and take over. And so, in 1975, it was Franklin I called to discuss my interest in Bonwit. At the time, I really had no track record. I was trying to get the Grand Hyatt off the ground, and I was still fighting for my convention center site, and nothing had yet gelled. But for whatever reason, Franklin Jarman was willing to see me. We met, and I told him straight out that I would love to buy the Bonwit Teller store and building. I knew this was a tough sell, so I tried to find ways to make the deal sound more attractive. I suggested, for example, that I would build above his store, and that he could keep it open during construction. That's not really feasible, but the point was that I would have done almost anything to get that piece of property. Even before I'd finished my pitch, I could see from the look on Franklin's face that he thought this was perhaps the most preposterous thing he had ever heard. When I was done, he said to me very politely, but also very firmly, "You've got to be crazy if you think there's any way we'd ever sell this incredible site." We shook hands, and I left. believing that under no circumstances would I or anybody else ever purchase this property. It was a dead issue. Even so, I didn't give up. I began writing letters to Franklin Jarman. First, I wrote to thank him for seeing me. A couple of months later, I wrote to ask if he might reconsider. When I got no answer and a few more months had gone by, I wrote again and said I'd love to drop by and see him again. More time passed, and I wrote another letter, suggesting a whole new way to make the deal. I was relentless. Even in the face of the total lack of encouragement, because much more often than you'd think, sheer persistence is the difference between success and failure. In this case, Franklin Jarman never budged from his original position. But as it happened, the letters I wrote eventually did have an impact. Almost 3 years passed after my first meeting with Franklin. During that time, Genesco began to experience very serious financial problems. I didn't give any of it a second thought until one evening in June 1978, when I picked up Business Week magazine and read an article about a management change at Genesco. The banks, trying to save the company from declaring bankruptcy, had insisted that a new chief executive be put in charge. The man's name was John Hannigan, and he was something of a turnaround artist. He'd just successfully saved AMF Brunswick, which had been ready to go down the drain. His specialty was something called pruning, which is just a nice way of saying that he took companies apart. In other words, he'd sell the assets, get rid of the debt, and pay off the banks. The key, for a guy like Hannigan, was that he came to companies without any emotional attachment to its people or its products. As a result, he had no trouble being ruthless. He was a tough, smart, totally bottom-line-oriented guy. At 9 sharp, the morning after I read the article, I called Genesco, and I got Hannigan on the phone. He'd just begun his new job, but to my surprise, he said, "I'll bet I know what you're calling about." "You do?" I said. And he said, "Yeah, you're the guy who has been writing all those letters about wanting to buy Bonwit Teller. When would you like to meet?" "As soon as possible," I said. He said, "Can you be here in half an hour?" It just shows you that sometimes making a deal comes down to timing. Somebody else might have called him a few days or a few weeks before me, and the whole thing could have turned out differently. Instead, I went to see him, and we had a very good meeting. It was clear that the company needed cash very badly and very quickly, and that he had no reluctance about selling Bonwit, or any other asset for that matter. It was like a giant garage sale. By the time I left, I thought there was a good chance we'd make a deal very quickly. Then something funny happened. Jack Hannigan suddenly refused to take my phone calls. I must have called him 10 or 15 times over a period of the next several days, but I never got through. I figured that some other bidder had come along and that in any case I was in trouble. I asked Louise Sunshine to speak to her friend Marilyn Evans, whose husband, David, owned a shoe company that he'd sold to Genesco several years before. He'd become a fairly large stockholder in Genesco, and that gave them some clout. Marilyn said they'd speak to Hannigan on my behalf, and almost immediately he called me back. I never found out what the delay had been about, but Hannigan suggested we have another meeting. This time I brought my lawyer, Jerry Schrager, and we were able to make a deal. It was really quite simple. Genesco owned the Bonwit building, but not the underlying land. For the land, they had a lease with 29 years left to run. I agreed to buy the building and their land lease for the sum of $25 million. In my mind, that was just the first step. In order to put up the building I had in mind, I was going to have to assemble several other adjacent pieces and then seek numerous zoning variances. That's often the situation in New York real estate. But in this case, I was dealing with an exceptionally prestigious, visible site, which meant every move I made was going to be unusually difficult and very carefully scrutinized. My most immediate problem was trying to keep the deal secret. I was convinced that if anyone got wind of the fact that the Bonwit site was up for sale before I signed a contract, I'd never make the deal. Once the Bonwit store went on the open market, everyone in the world was going to be after it, and the asking price will go right through the roof. That's why, after I'd shaken hands with Jack, I said to him, "Listen, I'd like to draw up a quick, simple letter of intent that says I've agreed to buy the property for $25 million, and you've agreed to sell it, subject only to the drawing of reasonable documents. That way, neither of us can walk away from the deal." To my surprise, Jack said, "Well, that sounds reasonable." Now, Jack is a very smart man, but he wasn't a New York guy, and he didn't realize how hot this property was. So valuable that even in the middle of a depression, there'd still be people lined up to buy it. Jerry and I drew up the letter of intent right then and there. Jack read it, and the only change he made was to stick in a clause making the sale subject to approval by his board of directors. When he handed it back to me, I said to him, "Listen, Jack, I can't live with that clause. In 3 or 4 weeks, you might tell your board of directors not to approve the deal, and that would defeat the whole idea of this letter of intent." Then I asked whether he needed approval from the board of directors to sell the store. He said he didn't, and I said, "Let's just take this one clause out." He gave it a little thought, and finally he agreed. I left the meeting with a deal, and something on paper to confirm it. Once I had the letter of intent from Jack Hannigan, but before I had a contract, I went to see a man named Conrad Stevenson at the Chase Manhattan Bank. My father had always done his business with Chase, and so I figured that was the best place to go first for the $25 million I needed to make the Bonwit purchase. I explained the deal to Connie, that I was buying the Bonwit building and their land lease, which had 29 years left to run, and that I hoped to put up a great skyscraper on the site. Immediately he said, "Unless you own the underlying land, that's not a long enough lease to justify financing." In other words, he was reluctant to put up money for me to purchase a site that 29 years later, when my lease ran out, could be taken over by the owner of the underlying land. But I'd taken that into consideration. I said to Connie, "Look, I've got two alternatives, and I think either one could work." The first one, I told him, was to do a very inexpensive conversion into an office building, with retail on the ground floor. Because I'd be paying such a low rent through the remainder of the lease, $125,000 a year, which was peanuts, even then, I was confident I'd be able to pay off my mortgage and still make a nice profit over the next 30 years. But Connie wasn't totally convinced. And even I considered the first option my worst-case scenario. What I really wanted to do, I explained, was to purchase not only the building and the lease, but also the underlying land. Then I said I could build a big building without risk of losing it at lease expiration. When I told Connie that the owner of the underlying land was the Equitable Life Assurance Society, he got excited for the first time. That, we both agreed, gave me a leg up, since I already had a great relationship with Equitable. They'd put up a big percentage of the financing for the Hyatt, and by this time the hotel was under construction. Things were going very well, and everyone was feeling terrific about the deal. The next thing I did was to set up a date to see George Peacock, the head of Equitable Real Estate. It was September 1978, just a month since I'd first sat down with Jack Hannigan. George and I met, and I told him I was in the process of purchasing the Bonwit lease, for which Equitable owned the land, and that I saw a chance to forge a partnership that could be very good for both of us. I would contribute my lease, I said, if they would contribute their land. Together, as 50-50 partners, we'd build a great new residential and office building on this incredible site. Equitable could have chosen simply to hold on to the site until the Bonwit lease ran out, and then own it outright. But the downside, I pointed out to George, was that then they would have to settle for a meager annual rent from a lease negotiated long before the value of New York real estate had begun to escalate. I also told George that my other option was to renovate the existing building and earn a more modest but still decent profit over the next 30 years. In truth, I was no longer certain that I could get financing for such a deal, but I didn't want him to think that a partnership with Equitable was my only option. Then he'd just feel free to drive a much harder bargain with me. Fortunately, George took to the idea of a partnership almost immediately. He was skeptical that I'd get the zoning necessary to build the huge building I had in mind, but he'd also seen what I'd achieved with the Commodore. By the time I left his office, he'd given me a commitment, subject to my delivering on my promises. Once again, I found myself juggling provisional commitments. My next move was to use my first two commitments, for the Bonwit lease and the Equitable Land, to try to get a third, from Tiffany. Specifically, I wanted to buy the air rights above Tiffany, which was directly adjacent to the Bonwit site at the corner of 57th and 5th. By purchasing those rights, I'd get something called a merged zoning lot, which would allow me to build a much larger building. Unfortunately, I didn't know anyone at Tiffany, and the owner, Walter Hoving, was known not only as a legendary retailer, but also as a difficult, demanding, mercurial guy. Even so, I'd always admired Hoving, because everything he'd ever touched had turned to gold. When he ran Lord & Taylor, it was the best, and when he ran Bonwit Teller, it was the best. And so long as he ran Tiffany, it was the best. I'd seen him at parties, and he was a man with impeccable manners, perfect white hair, beautifully tailored suits, and an imperial style. If you were casting a movie about the president of Tiffany, Walter Hoving would get the part.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.